Hello everybody, I hope that you guys are having a great week. Welcome to Inspired Earth. That was a pretty mind-bending episode of the last one that we had with the UFO jellyfish. And all the future UFO shows will have a listener discretion moving forward that things can get a little bit creepy or disturbing, but that's just for the UFO show, so you'll be ready to listen for Inspired Earth, right? After that, for some inspiring content. But I wanted to thank everybody who had emailed me and reached out to me and held me accountable that this should be for free, and I totally agree. And I'm a one-man show, just like Art Bell was, and he had decades to figure everything out. I'm still figuring things out. And one of the motifs of the emails that I had gotten and some of the feedback I had gotten from different forums and like all different places was that that they appreciated that I was real and genuine, and I really appreciated that, and I want to maintain that. And that involves honesty, that I might change plans or make a mistake. And thank you to the people who are holding me accountable to my roots, and that things should be free. It's hard to navigate this stuff, especially as a one-man show. It's difficult to know where to start and how to parse out so many different topics that are so closely interwoven while not being too long or keeping things interesting with little to no resources or expertise, because I haven't had any training in basically any of this. So I'm just winging it and learning from the hip, brand new, in my own bubble. I don't even know a lot of what's going on in UFO culture outside of just some select type of groups. But the majority of it, I don't even look at and participate in. So I'm just kind of like in my own thing over here. And that's for better and worse. So I appreciate the people that are keeping me consistent, that things need to be for free. And it would be nice to have a cartoon artist create like a cartoon for us to follow along with the things that I'm talking about. But we don't have the resources for that. But that would be fun. What I do have is knowledge and my experiences that I can present to you guys genuinely, and learn how to get better along the way with video editing and entertainment. So I just wanted to say that and thank everybody. And we're going to have this free. And for the people that did subscribe, and thank you to everybody that did subscribe to the Patreon. That was amazing. For everybody that did do that, you know, you guys are still going to have content. We'll do like some live experiments and stuff. Honestly, we might as well do some EVP experiments about the jellyfish and ask about the jellyfish, just straight up. I mean, that kind of popped out in my head, but I can also talk about some more personal stuff over there for everybody that subscribed, so thank you for that. And we will start today's episode. I just had to get that out of the way as a quick intro. So today we're going to be talking about Kenneth Arnold and the case for Nazis that just spills into everything. Like, you'll see what I'm talking about is it's hard to divvy up as soon as we start going into it. It's like, you know, rapid fire, boom, 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 that all these topics line up and interweave really, really far back and really far into the future. And, you know, who knows, but it gets crazy. So basically, to start off, we have to mention that there are several different groups of the Nazis who were working on exotic crafts. And it seemed like some of them were competing against one another, sometimes independently, sometimes working off one another, which seems like that's also occurring within our development of our government's spacecraft, that they sometimes compete with each other and sometimes work with each other, and that the companies split and go off all these different directions, and it becomes really hard to follow. But the different technologies affected the shape of the craft. So the technology that they were using affected how the craft looked. And we have Richard Meithe, M-I-E-T-H-E, who escaped the Americans. Let me pull that up right over here. That he escaped the Americans and worked on a Canadian flying disc car, and mentioned the technology was perfected in Germany. So we have Richard Meithe, who was working on the V-2 rocket, then that got captured by the Soviets, while Meath fled to the USA via France and ended up working for Avro, that Canadian company that I was talking about. And it says that a disc was developed by Rudolf Shriver and Klaus Herbermal at Prague, which consisted of a ring of moving turbine blades around a fixed cockpit, and Klein claimed that he had witnessed the craft's first crewed flight on the 14th of February 1945, when it climbed to 12,000 meters or 40,000 feet in 3 minutes and attained a speed of 2,200 kilometers or 1,400 miles per hour in level flight. So that says Richard Meithe guy went to Canada and developed the Avro car, and said that the designs had been developed in the Nazi era. And he identified two types of German flying discs, which is really interesting that he was even here saying that there's like multiple types of flying discs. So he mentioned a Rudolf Shriver, and Rudolf Shriver claimed he had worked with Heinkel as a test pilot and engineer, but it says it was never corroborated according to this page, which we know the history with this citation that I'm using right now. So the fact that it says that is interesting. We'll circle back to that here in a little bit. But in post-war Germany, Shriver drove supply trucks for the U.S. Army, apparently, but was constantly getting reports from foreign powers trying to get him to take on projects. So he's just a truck driver, but all these different nations were asking him to do stuff. But allegedly, he didn't do anything. And then aeronautical engineer Roy Frieden remarked that the only craft that could approach the capabilities attributed to flying saucers were those being designed by the Germans towards the end of the war. Frieden, who is also chief of the technical mission to Germany for the Ministry of Aircraft Production, stated in 1945, "I've seen enough of their designs and production plans to realize that if they, the Germans, had managed to prolong the war some months longer, we would have been confronted with a set of entirely new and deadly developments in air warfare." Frieden also added that Germans were working on a number of very unusual aeronautical projects, though he did not elaborate on his statement. And again, that's plural. That was plural. And then as far as Shriver, also, it says up here that Rudolf Shriver said that he had all of his documents stolen, and that apparently there's discrepancies in that. So those are some of the people that are immediately needing to be mentioned, that there are like a bunch of different people, like a whole segment of different people that are all working on this for the Nazis, and that a lot of them had escaped. And this is just the stuff that we know about, right? And that 1,400 miles per hour is pretty intense. And the fact that in the 50s, the Canadians were trying to make stuff that the Nazis had already perfected is really interesting. As well, it says that they fled to Czechoslovakia, which Czechoslovakia keeps on coming up over and over and over throughout this as well, I needed to mention. But Rudolf Shriver, the page says that like everything's made up about him and that his documents got stolen. But if you Google his name, you'll see that there's two copies of the same document mentioning him by the CIA, which I'll come over here and show you guys that Rudolf Shriver, I don't know how to pronounce this very well. I'm sorry, I'm not German, but if you just Google his name, the first things that come up are CIA.gov. And there's multiple. There's another one down here, too. And it's the same document. But it's saying that he had the first patent for the flying saucer. And that Rudolf Shriver was a former pilot. This is the document right here. And it's from 1953, unevaluated, which I also thought was interesting, that it's marked unevaluated. And this is reports of unconventional aircraft in French Africa, Corsica, Western Europe, basically like all over the world. They were having all these different objects and crafts and stuff. And then here they're saying flying saucer formations, specifically flying saucer formations, and that inventor in West Germany perfects flying saucer, Conquery La Guinea, November 52. The first patent for a flying saucer was recently applied for in West Germany by Rudolf Shriver, a former pilot, claimed to have perfected an elliptical flying object after 11 years of research. The inventor claimed that the craft, equipped with motors, has a diameter of 40 meters and can rise and descend vertically and remain motionless in the air. He estimated the speed as 4,000 kilometers an hour. And who knows if that worked, but it's interesting that like they are so interested in him and that they have all these documents and stuff. For somebody who had his documents stolen and didn't do anything and just drove trucks for the army, seems like he really did have some interesting insight to that, which is pretty out there. But I mentioned Roy Federman also, who's the British jet engineer, how he said that they might be having an entirely new and deadly development in air warfare. So the next name we have to mention is Winfried Otto Schumann, and we've already talked about him on Inspired Earth podcast, but it says here, Winfried Otto Schumann was a German physicist and electrical engineer who predicted the Schumann resonances in a series of low-frequency resonances caused by lightning discharges in the atmosphere, and that he was brought to the United States under Operation Paperclip in 1947-1948, where he worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base before he returned to his post in Munich. And that he worked at the Munich Laboratory, which subsequently became the Electrophysical Institute. So the Schumann resonance, if you guys remember, is somebody that had predicted the Schumann resonance, as it had already said. Our consciousness and subconscious each have their own energies, and the Schumann resonance interacts between our subconscious and conscious, and that they have electromagnetically and sound frequency their own energies. The Schumann resonance fits right in between that. We have talked about that paranormal stuff like UFOs, ghosts, electronic voice phenomenon also interact with electromagnetic frequencies in the area with sensors like K2 meters. And you can basically call this the unified theory of the paranormal, that all paranormal activity interact within this magnetic realm and that it can interact with our brain. And that can explain why the ET or ghosts or whatever know more about you than you know about yourself, is because they're interacting with your subconscious, as well as many other things, and how we can get information from the earth and knowledge from the ancients and telepathy and how some people can have events happen to them that nobody else can see or perceive because it's going on in this in-between state, and it can directly affect a person's brain specifically so that they're the only ones that are affected. And the Nazis were working on that back then. And the Soviets were working on that back then. And we find out that the CIA is working on it now and all the way back then. But this is the guy that helped them develop the engines, so to speak, for some of these craft. And then he went on to work at Wright-Patterson and the CIA, and all these public documents talk about human consciousness and frequencies dating back all the way to the 80s, probably a lot earlier, because this is, says he's working here in the 40s, so this is probably when he told them about all of this stuff. Then Operation Stargate with the remote viewers also talks about that. That's all public documents that you can see, and this is how the directors of the Hollywood movies that warned us could have been given their information, is through this magnetic interaction that we're talking about, that this guy would have taught them about. And there's documents talking about this type of thing being used for electricity, which is right here. This is a document from Electrical Stimulation for Immunomodulation publication, December 20th, 2023, talking about using magnetism and electricity to heal numerous diseases and chronic wounds, including autoimmune disease, cancer. So this has to do with medicine as well as consciousness. And then here we have evidence for consciousness-related anomalies and random physical systems, which was a Stargate document created, or it says that it was released in 2000. And document creation is 2016, so that doesn't make any sense. But this is from the Reading Room, Freedom Information Act. And it's talking about frequencies and consciousness. And, yeah, that all goes back to this. All comes back to the Nazis, which is kind of freaky. So, yeah, we kind of have been caught up with that. So now we have to go into Kenneth Arnold and what he saw. So here we have Kenneth Arnold pointing at the craft that he was saying that he had seen. And pay close attention to the shape here, all right, with this sort of thing. And then you see that it's, I think they call it like a manta shape or something like that. But check this out. Compare that to this shape right here. Does that look familiar? That looks exactly like what was just shown over there. I mean, that one in particular. And they had all these different models. This is from the Horton brothers, H-O-229. Horton, H-O-229. Which we still have actual copies of. This is a like an older version of it. This is the only surviving copy that the Americans were able to get. And they found it. And this is actually, I mean, you can see the tail area. Well, I mean, it doesn't have a tail, but you can see like the back end section right there. And that looks like an SR Blackbird. That looks like the back of a Blackbird. As soon as I'm looking at it, I can see that. But clearly, you can see that it's the exact same shape. So let's look at the specifications of what Kenneth Arnold said that he saw that day. And yeah, so it says that the objects were smaller than a DC-4 and that the reflections came flying from objects. They flew in a long chain, and Arnold for a moment considered they might be a flock of geese, but quickly ruled this out for a number of reasons, including altitude, bright glint and obviously very fast speed, and he thought they might be a new type of jet and started looking intently for a trail and was surprised he couldn't find any. Arnold describes them as a series of objects with convex shapes, though he later revealed that one object differed by being crescent shaped. Several years later, Arnold stated that he likened their movement to saucers skipping on water without comparing the actual shapes to saucers. So that's kind of important, the movement of skipping on water, like the top would go up and down, is what I am taking from that. It says slightly smaller than a DC-4, about the width between the outer engines, about 60 feet. So let's compare that to the HO-229. Said 60 feet, and then the HO-229 is 55 feet, so it's smaller. It's like the exact area that he's talking about. Also said he recognized the objects would have been quite large to see any details at that distance, and comparing notes with United Airlines crew that had a similar sighting 10 days later, placed the absolute size as larger than a DC airliner or greater than 100 feet. So it's weird that they went from like the small to the big, but the first one that he said was the one that matches HO-229. Basically perfectly. And it says that at first he thought that they were going 1,700 miles per hour, and that he went back and conservatively rounded down to 1,200 miles because he was like just arbitrarily like doing the math based on like picking distances in his head. So you go back and compare to the HO-229, and this is the version 2. So, like, his sighting was after the war, like, years after the war, 1947. So, assuming that they would, like, have time to work on this, they could improve it. And it says that the HO-229 has a top speed of about 600 miles per hour, or a little bit over. So, I mean, that's like double what we're talking about, but it's the exact same shape and size, which is pretty interesting. And then as well, the HO-229 was basically made to be a stealth bomber by making it out of wood and using carbon, impregnated carbon wood is what they call it, to reduce the signature of on radar. And then we basically took that exact same thing. I almost forgot to mention this, so I had to come back and re-record it. I had mentioned the skipping that Kenneth Arnold said that he mentioned, that they were like bouncing, seemed like, through the air, right? Well, that behavior is actually described in the design of the HO-229, as well as other flying wings that started with the HO-229. That the behavior at stall with flaps down was very satisfactory, that the nose dropped gently and the aircraft gained speed. Wing dropping could be induced if the aircraft was stalled in a yawed position, but normally wings remain level and ailerons still effective throughout restricted and movement. And the stall was reached with the stick not quite fully back. So, basically, once they started to stall, or if there was any sort of stabilization issue, whether it be like a crosswind or losing too much airspeed, the plane automatically dips back down, and that's its most stable flight, is like dipping down. And it dips down and then comes back up, and dips down and comes back up, like Kenneth Arnold was describing. So the flight characteristics sound almost identical to what he's seeing as well. So compare this HO-229 to the B-2 bomber, and you'll obviously see similarities. Now check out this even earlier Horton design. This is a flying triangle glider. And And you can kind of almost see like that dipping effect that he was talking about earlier whenever it was taking off there. But look at that flying. And look at it taking off. That looks like a B-2 bomber taking off. If you go and take a video of a B-2 bomber taking off, it's going to look exactly like that. So we have this exact shape and technology and stuff all the way back then in the with the HO-229. And it has the exact same shape and similar speed, and that it just disappeared straight into the mountain, is what he said. Is that the crafts just disappeared into the mountain, and he didn't understand where they went. And the HO-229 is made out of wood as well. Before we move on, I almost forgot to mention that Japan just made a satellite out of wood and is sending it to space. And Hindu crafts talk about space vehicles and like flying crafts being made out of wood, and they just used fluid dynamics and circulating like plasmas to create propulsion, and that they would make the craft out of wood. So the HO-229 being made out of wood really isn't as strange as it sounds. And then if you want to talk about discs, because some people say that like he did see a disc or whatever, well, this Rudolf Stryver also had invented these discs that were go flying. If you look at the pictures here, they're like flying at an angle with the front towards instead of flying straight like a plane, it puts the middle of the disc upwards and flies with the disc at an upward angle, like we're showing here. I'm trying to think of a different way to describe it, but that's what Bob Lazar had said, was that the discs raise up like that and then fly forward in that sort of motion. And if you start comparing the Stryver's flying top here, like the way that it looks with some other craft, it starts to become really, really interesting, that maybe they were mixing different technologies, and once they got this thing, it really took off, so to speak. So then we have the F-117, and it basically falls in line with this sort of exact sort of stuff as well. And you have to wonder if, similar to the last one that I just showed with Rudolf Stryver and his disc, if they were to put like a different sort of technology in there rather than a turbofan, what could that be? And you think the F-117, and if they were to turn it into something else by putting a different propulsion in it, could easily just end up looking basically exactly like the TR-3B, right? Which kind of looks like the Nazi-type crafts anyways. But you see the familiarity between these shapes, that we're talking about a bunch of triangles here. Triangle, triangle, triangle. All the way back to the Nazis. And they had stealth properties and like special coatings. And then let's compare the Phoenix lights. So, all right, I ended up getting it. Compare the Phoenix lights here to one of the earliest Horton Brothers glider concepts. Do you see that? That looks very similar. The Horton Brothers original glider shape is like nearly identical to the Phoenix lights. And then this is supposed to be the like more advanced version of the HO-229. The HO-229 was not their last version. They were planning on making something called the America Bomber, which this is a depiction of, that was supposed to be way more advanced, way faster, and could go longer than the HO-229. So once again, it doesn't surprise me that hypothetically they would continue on perfecting it, and that within a couple years they could have doubled the speed of this sort of thing. Okay, I almost forgot one thing here. Before the Nazis had gone into all of this, one of the things that they had done was they had all this occult knowledge, and some of it began with this, I'm just going to read the description here, legendary book starting point of the genre of science fiction, theosophy, New Age, the Force, and modern day conspiracy theory. It's a tale of subterranean master race able to control a mysterious energy force called the Vril. It inspired the Vril Society in German and beyond. It was believed by many to be a very thinly disguised reality. You owe it to yourself to peruse the highly entertaining and engaging seminal work. You see, many of our widely held beliefs today were spawned. So it's talking about the Force, and apparently even like Star Wars and stuff has stuff to do with this. But they're talking about subterranean race, and that they were tuning into this mysterious energy force called the Vril, and it made the Vril Society. Well, the Vril Society focused on getting telepathic communications of crafts to get engineering advice of how to build stuff. And Tesla also was doing the exact same thing. Tesla had made a machine to try to, an interplanetary like typewriter type of thing. And then Edison was talking about doing telephone to the dead with magnetism. And Tesla is talking about talking to space people with magnetism. And the Vril was using this telepathic stuff, which it goes back to the Schumann thing, the Schumann resonance, that this magnetic force that connects our subconscious and conscious, that we can interact with it. And these people allegedly trained how to do that to get this engineering concepts. And the Vril Society allegedly created Hanabu 2 spacecrafts, Hanabu 1, 2, and 3, and as well as maybe some other ones. But this is like not confirmed, but the FBI talks about this stuff in some documents, and it's just really interesting that they would talk about all this occult knowledge and stuff that apparently they had knowledge about, but other people didn't, and they were like trying to figure out who had knowledge of what. So yeah, apparently, allegedly, some Nazi like psychic secret society people telepathically came up with this flying saucer thing. However, we already know with Rudolf Strieber that this was like not psychically engineered, and that they had a flying saucer looking type stuff that was successful and could go super duper fast and super high, even without psychic technologies. So let's just say hypothetically that they were to combine the two. I mean, look at this thing. It looks exactly like a modern day UFO. And yeah, just hypothetically, what would happen if you were to combine the two? And then look at this. A lot of these end up looking like a acorn type of stuff. So yeah, we'll just keep that in mind, that some of it looks like acorns, because some of that goes back to Hinduism again. And I don't want to like blow anybody's mind too much more, so we'll just leave it at that. Now, David Paulides had said that people go missing on Mount Rainier, and that similar to the crafts that Kenneth Arnold had seen that just completely disappeared. Then we know that Nazis used slave labor to make these crafts and the facilities to make it, like tens of thousands of people, the scale of which we're still not sure. And tens of thousands of people died during the making of that, and we're still not even sure of exactly what they were doing, which is crazy that thousands of people died and we still have no idea what they were doing. And there's a YouTube channel that goes into that. It's called Forgotten Battlefields. Let me get it up on the screen here. This is the page right here, Lost Battlefields with Tino Struckman, and he's done work with the Travel Channel, I think, but his whole show here of the Last Nazi Secret series, that one is so good, and that's where they talk about all of this stuff that, like, I just started. I'm literally, like, on the second episode, but it's crazy because he goes to all of these actual locations where they're building the actual facilities, and he even shows you at the beginning here too that exactly what I was talking about, the Horton glider flying right next to the B-2 bomber. It's exactly the same. But I do want to show one quick part here to see if I can find it, that they had designed the whole facility here, right here. They had designed the whole facility with the slaves' psychology in mind. And that's creeped me out so much, was that they had these hallways, and you can't have lines of people going through hallways that are slaves, because they're going to be able to see what's ahead, what's behind. They're going to have way too much information than what the Nazis had wanted them to. So what do? Create these blinder ports where you're limiting the transitional spaces that slaves can see, like what they can see, what they can know, what they can hear, who they can see. It's all limited. And the whole facility's infrastructure was designed around the psychology of the slaves and limiting transitional spaces. And that tells you, like, how important slave labor was to these people. And so David Paulides is saying that people are going missing off of the mountain, and that he's detected a pattern throughout all of the missing cases, that they're, like, blonde, blue-eyed Germans being abducted unusually high, along with doctors and experts, and that, like, people with German heritage in general, not just blonde and blue-eyed, but those in particular as well, and that, you know, the Nazis went to South America after the war, and there were some of the worst human mutilations have occurred in South America. Take, for example, the Peruvian face peelers, maybe, and those have been talked about for thousands of years as well. It goes back to Hinduism, and where did the Nazis get their mythos from? From Hinduism. And yeah, I guess that's enough. We'll come back and circle back and talk some more about all this and let you guys process, because that was a lot. But that's what I'm saying. It's hard to differentiate and, like, divvy up where to begin, and because it all goes in between one another. It all comes back to the Nazis. That's what it always comes back to. And then after that, it goes back to Hinduism and the circle of time that this sort of stuff has been going through.